is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, some compelling information has been coming out in recent weeks in the increasing cost of healthcare in the country, especially when it comes to insurance coverage.
Well, indeed, this is a topic that we have been examining on the show really now for years. And there are some trends in the wake of the Affordable Care Act worth noting. After several years of historically low increases in health insurance costs for consumers, the rates for 2017 are out, and some insurance consumers are going to see 25% increases in premiums for next year, something I think we all, including the president, were hoping to avoid.
Analysts have pointed to insurers setting rates during the first few open enrollments that were based on speculation that there would be more participation from young people. But that demographic has been slow to respond to the insurance mandate. Rates have been readjusted for the next year to reflect the higher proportion of older, sicker participants and the lack of competition in certain marketplaces, as many large insurers have also pulled out of the exchange.
And employer-based insurance is demanding more out-of-pocket costs than ever before for consumers who get coverage through their employers. The Commonwealth Fund just released a very detailed outline of costs state by state, and we're seeing some pretty clear pictures emerge. States like Texas, Florida, and Arizona that did not expand Medicaid for their poorest residents have some of the highest insurance costs per consumer. But really, everywhere, consumers seem to be paying more in out-of-pocket costs.
Mm-hmm. And as we look at the rising cost of care, about $3.5 trillion spent on health care annually in this country, the focus is shifting. A growing number of entities are promoting more cost awareness in care delivery.
And that is something that our guest today is very focused on. Dr. Neal Shah is a Harvard-based physician, also founder of Costs of Care, a global organization that's aimed at promoting value-based care in medical training. It's a trend that is resonating with students of the health professions as they enter the healthcare marketplace and ask the question, how can we deliver high-quality care that also reflects value for the patients as well as the healthcare industry?
Looking forward to this conversation and also looking forward to Laurie Robertson, managing editor of FatCheck.org, looks at misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain. But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com.
And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter, because we love to hear from you.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hara, with this week's headline news.
Mariano here with these healthcare headlines. Come January, Vermont will become the first state in the nation to move to a voluntary, all-payer, accountable care organization model. Vermont is using a grant from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid for the ACO initiative, which will require the same payments for providers treating patients in Medicare, Medicaid, as well as commercial entities. Vermont Governor Peter Shumlin is lauding this initiative, saying that Vermont will be the first state attempting to transform the entire healthcare system so that it will fundamentally promote keeping people healthy versus spending money. Governor Shumlin's earlier efforts to pass the nation's first single-payer system fell by the wayside in 2014 when it was determined the plan would be too cost-prohibitive. Open enrollment getting underway November 1st for the Affordable Care Act marketplaces, with much hullabaloo over the estimated 25% increase in some regions of the country. States that expanded Medicaid and had a robust competition in the marketplaces have seen far lower rate increases in some cases. But the carrot-and-stick approach in the ACA doesn't seem to be having the desired effect so far. Many people are weighing their options of going without insurance coverage altogether during this next round of open enrollment, opting instead to take the tax penalty come tax time next year. Many say the penalty, about $700 for a single person, doesn't create enough incentive to adhere to the insurance mandate. While most marketplace consumers who purchase insurance on the exchanges, about 85%, receive some kind of tax subsidy, meanwhile, what are Americans most concerned about when it comes to their health care costs? It's not the price of insurance that keeps them up at night. It's drug costs. According to a Kaiser Family Foundation poll, 75% of those polled saw the rising cost of pharmaceuticals as their greatest cause for concern. According to Kaiser's October tracking poll, majorities of Democratic, Republican, and independent voters all support making sure high-cost drugs for chronic conditions are affordable for patients who need them. Fewer than a third of voters favored proposals to repeal requirements of the health law for employers to provide insurance to their workers or pay a fine. Ah, the cranberry, the little red berry born of the bog, rich in vitamin C and loads of antioxidants. Long held to be one of nature's best little fighters against the urinary tract infection. But a study produced at Yale finds otherwise. A study conducted by the Yale School of Medicine found women in a nursing home given high-dose cranberry supplements for a year showed no less incidence of urinary tract infections than those not given intervention. Lead author Dr. Manisha Jethani Mehta said she was hoping for different results that might offer a protective benefit. Based on the study's findings, she says it may not be worth the expense of promoting supplements to protect against UTIs. I'm Ariane O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Dr. Neil Shaw, founder and executive director of Cost of Care, a global NGO that seeks to help delivery systems provide better care at lower cost. He's the co-author of the highly acclaimed Understanding Value-Based Healthcare. Dr. Shaw is an assistant professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive biology at Harvard Medical School with a practice at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's an associate professor at the Ariadne Labs for Health Systems Innovation, where he leads a 50-hospital consortium linking administrative management to clinical performance. He was named as one of Becker's Hospital Review 40 Smartest People in Healthcare. He earned his master's in public policy at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard and his MD at Brown University. Dr. Shaw, welcome to Conversations in Healthcare.
Thanks so much.
Oh, you learned pretty early in your medical training about the huge variations in healthcare pricing and how medical training did very little to prepare future clinicians for thinking about delivery from the value perspective. And you and a couple of your partners launched Cost of Care in 2009. I'm wondering if you could share with our listeners more about the goals of the organization and how that mission has evolved.
Absolutely. So generally the way medical school works, you spend about a quarter century in a classroom, and then when you're in 25th grade or so, when you're a third year medical student, they finally let you put on a white coat and touch real patients. And I actually signed up for medical school at a young age at 18. I was at a program at Brown that's like a Brown for Life thing. You sort of do four years of college, and then you go right into med school. Mm-hmm. And my idea of being a doctor was mostly based on what I'd seen on TV. And during your third year of medical school, your job is to kind of walk into every door of the hospital and learn what happens there. For the first time, I got a sense of our fallibility as well. And in particular, I noticed that, you know, in Providence, Rhode Island, where I was in school, they're not the ones with the deep pockets. Mm-hmm. And I noticed that we were making a lot of decisions in a vacuum without really any sense of how our decisions impacted what patients were paying. And the most surprising thing to me was that when you're a third-year medical student, everybody above you seems omniscient. You know, even the fourth-year medical students seem to know everything. And this was the one thing that even the most esteemed professors didn't really have a lot of insight into.
Well, Dr. Shaw, the notion of value-based care, I think, has finally started to really gain some traction in this country. And certainly, I'd give some credit to that, maybe to the policy initiatives in the Affordable Care Act. But you are an OBGYN. You practice within a pioneer ACO. So you've had a pretty firsthand look at some of the real challenges in getting organizations and practitioners to think more about value-based care. And you say it's not an operational change for practitioners, but it's really a huge cultural change. What have been some of the greatest challenges so far in shifting the culture?
I mean, I think often when people talk about healthcare reform, they're conflating two things. There's payment reform, and then there's delivery reform. And I think the Affordable Care Act, accountable care organizations, sort of risk-based contracting or value-based payments, a lot of that has to do with the sort of top-down incentive to think more about value. You know, in 1994, you were still getting AOL CDs sent to you in the mail, and that was the state of the Internet.
Right.
Whereas today, the Internet's very, very different, and every other purchasing decision we make is based on, you know, Yelp and Travelocity and other sites that have transparent quality and pricing information. And I think in 2015, there's a similar expectation that we should be able to do the same in healthcare. At the same time, a lot of patients are facing very high deductibles. So I think, you know, where patients are with this, both in terms of their exposure to cost and in terms of their expectations around information and transparency, is very different. And I think in many ways, that's what's pushing not just payment reform, but like delivery reform. And now it's incumbent on us as clinicians to figure out how we fundamentally re-engineer the way we deliver care. And, you know, that takes some heavy lifting for sure.
You know, I think there's, Dr. Shaw, a lot to rejoice about in the Affordable Care Act in terms of the coverage it's provided millions of Americans. But there's been a dramatic rise in recent years in the out-of-pocket expenses for many of those Americans covered under the Affordable Care Act. And you noted in Massachusetts that, which has had almost about a decade of universal coverage, health expenditures are still a leading cause of personal bankruptcy and financial difficulty for consumers. And so tell our listeners about the solutions that Cost of Care is looking at to incentivize players and payers and providers and consumers alike.
You know, we were 7-8 years ahead of the rest of the country in terms of covering everyone in Massachusetts, but now we're 7 or 8 years ahead in terms of running out of money to pay for it, mm-hmm. which we're much less proud of. And because we didn't have, especially nationally with the Affordable Care Act, it's not like we had a new pot of money. We just sort of spread it around more. And so there's more people in the system, but those people have less good insurance. The average silver plan, if you sign up for health insurance on the exchange, has deductible that's $3,000, $4,000, $5,000, mm-hmm. which is real money for most people. Mm-hmm. And then when you couple that with all of the sort of arbitrariness around pricing, you know, one CT scan will right. be a big part of that deductible. So in terms of our work, and it goes back to the original question around sort of our mission and how it's evolved, we've organized our efforts into three areas. We started off primarily as an advocacy organization, trying to build will within the profession, the clinical professions, to consider cost. Because not only was I not taught very much about costs when I was a medical student, but I was actually specifically taught that costs weren't something I should mm-hmm. be thinking about. So what we've done over the years is we've collected now over 500 stories, real stories from patients, clinicians, and healthcare administrators as well from all over the country that illustrate these sort of routine opportunities to make care more affordable for patients. And we've disseminated them to well-positioned stakeholders. And in doing that, we've tried to bring attention to all the opportunity there is to improve care around affordability just by making different decisions. But then the clinicians on the ground really didn't have the skills or tools or knowledge that they needed. There was still something missing, and that's where the book that you mentioned came from. And then we realized that you can educate clinicians, they can have the will to consider costs, but if you embed them in systems that set them up for failure, you're not doing any good. So we now have an implementation piece of our work, too, that's trying to think about how you design the system around the clinician to help them make better choices.
Well, Dr. Shaw, I want to talk about your book, Understanding Value-Based Care. Don Berwick, the president emeritus at the Institute for Healthcare Improvement, who we all know for his contributions to patient safety, called this book an instant classic because it offered frontline clinicians a raft of practical ideas to make healthcare dramatically safer, more patient-focused. So let's talk about those actionable strategies. What are those actionable strategies for individual clinicians or organizations?
We were very careful in the book to make sure that it wasn't a health policy book. You know, the book starts off by just sort of trying to help people understand why we are where we are now, including why are healthcare prices so opaque. Because when you look at the average American medical bill, if you're actually staring at a medical bill and you're a physician or a nurse, it's probably like the first time you've really scrutinized one. The second problem is that the prices are arbitrarily determined and often inflated. But the problem with that issue is that clinicians don't feel ownership over that issue because they don't set prices. The third problem, which is the much bigger problem that clinicians directly own, though, is that a lot of the line items on the average bill don't need to be there. You know, about a third of the things that we decide to order as clinicians don't measurably improve healthcare outcomes. But we found in our research and in our work that there's actually 10 to 20 other distinct reasons why clinicians do this, which, you know, is much lower hanging fruit than, say, tort reform. And then we get down to really concrete strategies like how to do high value prescribing, all the way to how to actually design value improvement projects within your delivery system.
We're speaking today with Dr. Neil Shaw, founder and executive director of Cost of Care and also co-author of Understanding Value-Based Healthcare. Dr. Shaw is assistant professor of obstetrics, gynecology, and reproductive biology at Harvard Medical School and is a professor at the Ariadne Labs for Health Systems Innovation. And Dr. Shaw, you give a great example of how healthcare has gone far off track, and that's the dramatic rise in C-sections performed in this country. I'm not sure if our listeners know it's currently the most commonly performed surgery in the United States, and we've had Leah Binder from Leapfrog Group on the show discussing their transparency campaign regarding hospital C-sections. Tell us the kind of strategies you've deployed in your own practice that might be an example for others?
The 50-year view in healthcare, like in 1955, Dwight Eisenhower has a heart attack as the sitting president, and they tell him to sleep it off. He gets like a month of bed rest. In 2015, he would have gotten a beta blocker and an angiogram and a stent, and he would have lived 10 years longer. And over the last 20 years, the patient safety movement has focused so much on the problem of too little that in many cases, we've overcorrected. And C-sections is, I think, the perfect example where it's become 500% more common. And what Leah Binder and others have found, actually, is that one of your biggest risk factors for getting a C-section isn't your own risks or preferences, but it's literally which door you walk through. It's like which hospital you go to. And our own work, especially thinking about realizing that it's something about the hospital that's driving this, has been really key. With C-sections, you know, a normal delivery first time, it can easily take 20 hours from when you go into labor to when the baby gets delivered, whereas a C-section takes me 30 minutes. I just did one. And, you know, so there's always a sort of implicit incentive to expedite the process. Emergency medicine physicians face the same sort of thing where, you know, they've got a complex patient who comes into the ED. They can either admit, which is the low resistance pathway, or they can coordinate care and send them back out into the wild. And so, you know, in many instances in healthcare, we face these sorts of choices, and the strength of the incentive to take the low resistance pathway depends on a lot of factors in the clinical environment, including how the hospital's managed.
Well, Dr. Shah, another big opportunity, I guess, is at the level of the practice, right, whether that's private practice or community health center or outpatient clinic, to make the decisions about ordering tests and prescribing medications. And we've followed with such interest, in part because one of the physicians on our medical staff, Dr. Smith, Steve Smith, has been a leading architect in this. And that's the Choosing Wisely campaign, which, as you know, was launched a couple of years ago now by the American Board of Internal Medicine Foundation with support from the National Quality Forum and many specialty groups. And their goal is to get providers to think very carefully about the evidence and the need for ordering a test versus the habit of both what we've always done and certainly what we've kind of trained patients to expect we're going to do, and also the overprescription of drugs. Talk about how programs like Choosing Wisely tie into your view of how we can make a difference in scaling back on things which are unnecessary and affecting the cost of care that way.
Absolutely. First of all, Steve Smith was my dean of medical education
all the way back when I was in medical school.
Yeah. So absolutely, Choosing Wisely has been tremendous. It's become an international movement now, with several countries from India to Australia to Italy, Canada, all have versions of this. In the U.S., I think there's more than 80 specialties now that all have these lists of the five things within their clinical purview that we do routinely but maybe don't have to. And there's a couple things that are really powerful about it. One is that the clinical specialties are taking ownership, you know, including like radiologists and cardiologists and oncologists and other folks who, you know, use a lot of expensive healthcare resources are saying, you know, these are five things that we do that we don't need to routinely. And then the other thing that they do is they take the existing evidence for what we should do and they reframe it in terms of the evidence for what we shouldn't do. And I think that's really powerful too. The challenge, though, is that there are many things in medicine for which we have excellent evidence, but it doesn't really change practice. And I think that's sort of where we are with Choosing Wisely now. We've sort of gotten to a point where we've raised great awareness of these issues, but then there's that second step of, you know, closing the gap between what we know we should do and what we actually do. And one of the best examples of this gap, I think, is hand washing. You know, as an obstetrician 150 years ago figured out, before we knew anything about bacteria, that if you wash your hands, you cut mortality in half. As we learned during the Ebola outbreak in Texas, people are still working on hand washing. For us, actually, the hand washing example was a great clue into how to close the gap, because although we're still imperfect at hand washing, we've improved a lot, and we've improved relatively recently by thinking about the barriers to hand washing. The fact that, you know, there was a day actually when I was a medical student where, you know, you walk in and suddenly hand sanitizer became a thing. And washing your hands went from a couple-minute operation to being, you know, less than a minute. They started to institute 360-degree feedback. So if you don't use the Purell before walking into the patient room, the nurse or the patient probably will call you out on it. And then most importantly, you know, they started to flag hospital-acquired infections. So if you were the one spreading MRSA from room to room, it would get really awkward for you very quickly. And then, you know, lo and behold, hand washing got better. And I think with value, there's a lot of really similar things. If you think through the full incentives, you know, it occurred to me when I was a resident, academic medical centers are rampantly overutilizing care. They're the most expensive places to get care in the country. Yet the residents are not really motivated by fee-for-service because they're basically indentured servants. And they're not motivated by medical malpractice because they're relatively protected. There's layers of hierarchy between them and the lawsuit. And yet they still overorder. And often it has to do with other things that can similarly be systematically solved for. It has to do with trying to preempt your future work. So, you know, if you can order 5 tests and not think about it again, or you can order 1 test and then wait 3 hours and occupy a stretcher, that's less good. And so that suggests a very different kind of solution.
Dr. Shaw, you have a busy and productive life in addition to your practice in the organization Cost of Care in your book. You're also associate professor at the Ariadne Labs based in Boston, and it's a Harvard-based research lab linking hospitals around the world to best practices that can improve childbirth and maternity experience. Could you talk about the research you're doing there and who you're partnering with around the world and what you're learning from this consortium?
Absolutely. So Ariadne Labs is a institute that was founded by Atul Gawande a couple years ago, and it came out of the work that they did with the surgical safety checklist, which, you know, the same way that a pilot has to run a checklist before hitting the throttle, now surgeons have to do the same before picking up the scalpel, and this intervention reduces mortality in half from all surgeries on every continent, basically. So it was
amazing, isn't it?
Absolutely amazing. I think after the smallpox vaccine, really? I think the WHO thinks it's like the most impactful thing that they did. So, you know, so there was some thinking about what else, and what are the lessons, especially around not even creating the checklist, but getting to this implementation problem we were just talking about. How do you actually get people to follow it? There are a lot of lessons from that. And so this institute grew up around this idea that, you know, quality improvement traditionally is very local, right? It's like an administrative function, and there's this sense that quality improvement projects don't scale. In fact, if you're trying to do a quality improvement research project, often you don't even need IRB approval because it's assumed that it has no applicability outside your hospital. But the surgical safety checklist sort of proved that, and many other things, medical reconciliation, you know, a lot of these things were truly scalable in ways that made people better. So this is basically a shop that's run by a surgeon, so it's not a diagnosis shop, it's an intervention shop, where the idea is to do this in a variety of healthcare domains. And as an obstetrician, I'm thinking hard about childbirth and the fact that the hospital you go to is your number one risk factor for having major surgery. And so we, as part of our work, we created a consortium of 50 hospitals across the country to help us think about what was different from the hospitals that had, you know, that were high-performing and low-performing, and what are the lessons that we can extract and scale.
We've been speaking today with Dr. Neil Shah, founder of Costs of Care and co-author of Understanding Value-Based Care, published by McGraw-Hill. You can learn more about his work by going to costofcare.org or find them on Twitter at Costs of Care. Dr. Shah, thank you so much for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today.
Thanks so much for having me.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
Donald Trump claimed that a 25% average increase in premiums on the healthcare.gov exchanges announced by the Obama administration was a, quote, phony number. He instead cited increases of 60, 70, 80%. But Trump just as easily could have cherry-picked increases in the single digits. The fact is, the administration's report shows wide variation for the change in premiums. That variation ranges from a 116% average increase for the second lowest cost silver benchmark plan for a 27-year-old in Arizona to a 3% average decrease for those plans in Indiana. There's a mere 2% average increase in the swing state of Ohio, but a 53% average hike in neighboring Pennsylvania. It all adds up to an average 25% increase across the 38 states on healthcare.gov from 2016 to 2017. The median increase is 16%. That's without factoring in government subsidies. But in presidential campaign appearances in Florida, Trump claimed the 25% average increase number was, quote, so wrong, and that, quote, they know that's not true. What is true is that some plans sold on the Affordable Care Act exchanges are expected to go up considerably for 2017. As the October 24th report released by the Department of Health and Human Services shows, there are three states with average increases for benchmark plans above 60%. More states likely have individual insurance plans that go up that high, even though the average increase across all plans is much lower. For instance, the HHS report shows the average increase for the benchmark plan for a 27-year-old in Texas is 18%, but there's wide variation within the state. In Dallas County, the average increase is only 7%, but in Medina County, which includes San Antonio, the jump is nearly a doubling. Tax credits change what many consumers will actually pay. 84% of the 10.4 million Americans with marketplace coverage in the first half of 2016 received tax credits. Those put a cap on the amount an individual must contribute toward benchmark premiums based on income. The wide variation in premium changes among states and different individual circumstances for those buying their own coverage under the Affordable Care Act shows that a nationwide average increase doesn't tell the whole story. But that doesn't mean the number is phony. And that's my fact check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, managing editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare.
Each week, Conversations highlights a bright idea about how to make wellness a part of our communities and everyday lives. Clubfoot is one of the most common childhood deformities in the world, a condition that in the past was not correctable without the intervention of expensive and invasive surgeries. In low-resource parts of the world, access was nearly impossible, and as a result, clubfoot is the leading cause of disability in the developing world.
The effects on the child are devastating. It also has an incredible impact on the mom. These kids have to be taken care of, and often the mother is blamed for having a child with any kind of a problem, as well as having a child with a disability. So devastating for the whole family.
But a breakthrough treatment called the Ponseti method has changed all of that. Cheska Colorado Mansfield was an employee at the University of Iowa where this new, non-invasive, inexpensive intervention was developed, which corrected the problem in a series of months, often before a child even begins to walk.
The healthcare provider gently manipulates the tendons and ligaments in the foot and moves the foot about 10 to 15 degrees and then places the feet in a long leg plaster of Paris cast. That cast stays on for 1 week, and then they repeat the process, and they just gradually move the feet.
She and her colleagues founded Miracle Feet, a nonprofit organization that identifies children throughout the world born with club feet, who can be treated for about $250 per child, a tiny fraction of what the surgery would cost. Today, Miracle Feet supports over 100 clinics through partnerships with 25 different partners in 12 different countries, already having given thousands of children in the developing world the chance to walk, run, play, and to grow into productive adults. Miracle Feet has earned numerous awards for its innovative treatment design and its ability to be easily deployed in low-resource settings.
They have to sleep in a brace at night. The one that we've made is made out of plastic. We came up with a brace that the shoes clip on and off, it's adjustable, the angles are fixed, and we can produce it for $20. So we've essentially come up with a design that enables us to do everything the U.S. brace does, but for a fraction of the cost.
Miracle Feet, providing a low-cost treatment for children born with club foot around the world, giving them a chance to live active and fully productive lives. Now that's a bright idea.
This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from the campus of WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org and brought to you by the Community Health Center.